talk between yourselves and tell us about the incorporation.
Tell them they give their name first.
And your name and...
My name is Marto Solomon. I was a member of the city council when it first incorporated. Back around 1952 or 53. And now, in order for us to incorporate, we had to have a president as a leader. And that we started off new. And in order to have sales tax and thereby get our streets in shape and have our own police department. Well, we didn't have any police protection in Fort Yukon. We had to have sales tax. We incorporated. And as I remember, Reverend Marston was the first president. And then, I don't know when it was that I was elected president. I don't even remember how long a period of time that we were a president and what the election procedure was. But Don Young followed me, and now at the present time, Jonathan Solomon is the mayor.
I'm John Thomas. I was born and raised here. And as Marto say, about that time, one of the reasons we incorporated is that at that time we had the territory of Alaska for the state. And apparently they didn't pay too much attention to native councils and such. And we wanted to run our own show. So the only way we could do it was to incorporate. If I remember right, some of the guys got together and got a petition, is how it was then and probably still is, about 25 signatures, and petitioned the territory of Alaska to become a fourth-class city. And they approved that, and of course they had an election. And like Marto said, I believe Reverend Marston was the first president. And it was... Well, we wanted to run our own show, if I remember right. Among our budgets were about $7,000-$8,000 a year, which was pretty low. But anyway, we got along as well as we could, and as time went by, things sort of grew, and we got revenue sharing, and we started originally at 2% sales tax. And as time went by, we discovered that it wasn't enough. So we had another referendum and upped it to 3%. And any number of people served on the council. At one time, I was vice president under with Don Young, way after Marto. So probably if you look around, you'll find a lot of people that have served as time went by. So, and then, as I said, things got bigger and more money involved, and we decided at one time to have a city manager form of government, because we had to run it, we had to run the city through council, which was rather unhandy. We met once a month and we decide what to do. We try to do this, but from day to day, as things came up, we couldn't function, because who knows where Marta would have been, and or anybody else. So we decided to go to a city manager form of government that would run it from a day-to-day operation, which is more practical. And then, as time went by, well, like Mardo said, we wanted street lights, police protection. If I remember, we had a deputy U.S. Marshal here as law enforcement. But it was rather unhandy. We wanted our own city police, because it was mostly federal stuff that he took care of. See, we were a territory, so we had no state police as such, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We had territorial police, mm-hmm. right. But, this,
they were in Fairbanks.
They were in Fairbanks, right, right.
Any good local problems?
Yes, if anything would happen, well, it would take, who knows, days, weeks, and everything had been forgotten. So as more money became available, we could hire our own city police and operate our own jail, and we could handle things more ourselves. And as it, you know, 30 years, it sort of got bigger and bigger, and we have a city manager now, and there's a couple of city police, and who knows how many city employees.
What was the population when you started this incorporation?
I would say between 400 and 500
mm-hmm.
people, I would say. Yeah. I don't know. And I would guess there's something like 700 now, not counting, for instance, the base.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, this was way before the Air Force was here. And planes were coming in very infrequent. During the winter, we'd have 3 flights a week from Fairbanks. And then when summer tourists came, we had daily flights, and we thought that's real living.
Yeah.
I mean, now there's probably 10 flights a day between here and Fairbanks. And, of course, there was no electric lights, no telephones. But as time went by, the lights, Mr. Toussaint started with a little light plant, and he hooked up 2-3 houses, and then 5 or 6, and pretty soon it was all over.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we got telephones and TV as of now.
When did telephones come in? Do you know about the time?
68. I was just looking at mine today, and it said, when do you start? When the start was 68. And I remember it right now because I've got it all right on my desk. I got to pay my bill. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. But if I remember right, about 20 phones was the first. They hooked up interior telephone, came in, put in their equipment, and they got subscribers, and there was 20 originally. And then, of course, who knows how much there is now? I don't know. And then we got, as we could afford it, the city paid for the street lights, of course, put them up. They might have had Mr. Toussaint put them up, but they strictly paid for it themselves. And if I remember right, was straight X number of dollars a year for so many lights. And we put one or two here. And then a few years later, as we had more money, put a few more here and a few more there. And it's fairly well lit now. But I remember one little instance that when we started with electric lights, the minimum charge was $3 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people were saying that Mr. Toussaint would go, giving him a plug. But anyway, they said he'd go broke, because look, you've got X number of gallons of fuel, and you've got 50 houses on there at $3 a month. Anybody can figure $150. But apparently, he knew people, and that $3 a month minimum, X number of kilowatts, I forgot how it was, but he would go broke. But he knew people better than other people did. So what happened, of course, you had one electric light, and pretty soon, I need 3 or 4. And then I said, hey, you know, a toaster would be real nice. An electric plate and a coffee pot. I can't even shave now without electricity, I tell you. If the electricity went out, I'd grow a beard right quick, because I don't know what happened to my regular shaver. I threw it away, I guess. So we get used to it.
Yes.
And he apparently knew people. Well, this is natural that you would get more lights and more convenience, you know, and that electric washers and dryers, and probably some people have stoves or hot plates, and like I said, coffee pots and toasters and waffle iron. I've got them all. If I don't watch the wife, she'll use them all at one time. But it made it more convenient. And the fact that we complain about the high cost of electricity, but we just ask somebody to go without for a while.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, hey, no way.
You mentioned the flood of 1949. Do you think that had something to do with getting incorporated?
No. No, it didn't. We had to move up into a higher ground. And we had a chief up till that time, but after we moved, it seems like everything was up in the air. We weren't organized. There was nothing. So in order to help ourselves, we had to get incorporated. We don't have, at that time, we didn't have the agencies, the government agencies that helped the villages. We didn't have the town or chiefs. So it was just up to us. So we had to try something, and that's how we just incorporated. But Johnny mentioned that we had an operating budget of $7,000, and that is correct. It was $7,000 flat. Now, Marston was the first president, and then I was a second president after Marston was. And the president and the city council are not employed. And I didn't have very much income. So I got out of it. And I took the job of treasurer for the city of Fort Yukon, $15 a month. $15 a month.
That
was big money in those days.
That was probably among the first
employees.
Yeah.
Because like Mardu said, no one was paid.
Mm-hmm.
And we had city police, but they were paid. A lot of them did it for nothing. And before that, our city treasurer and clerk, we'd find somebody that's kind-hearted that would do a little work for nothing.
Yeah.
Because we just didn't have the money. And as time went by, we had a watering point, if I remember right,
mm-hmm.
down
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
And we paid somebody to keep it open. Oh, 2 hours a day, maybe 5 days a week, and paid them for that. But that took the major portion of our income. It took.
He was getting paid $2 an hour.
Right, and it took practically all of it.
Yeah.
And what little left the city police got as mm-hmm. part time. And it was. I remember one time. This is a good one. We had a potential flood coming in. It was a weekend, of course, and the slaughterhouse was closed, and we're saying to ourselves, you know, we should open that darn thing and let people get water. They fill up their water barrels, so if our water lines did break or get flooded, we'd have at least some water. If I remember right, I went down and I saw Mardu, and I says, look, we got to get that thing open. And he says, well, you know, it's a good idea, but next council meeting, somebody will say, how come we spend all that money? You know, maybe $6 or $8.
Yeah.
So I saw a couple of the other council members, and I says, look, we gotta open it. I was working for the state of Alaska by that time, too, as a sanitation technician, see? So I was interested in water.
Yeah.
This was my thing. So I see, I saw Mardu, and I saw a couple of the other guys, and I said, look, boys, we got to open that water house so people will get water. Now, the next council meeting, we're going to have to say, you know, the three or four of the council members going to have to say, we thought it was a good idea then to cover our tracks for spending this $8-$10, say.
Yeah.
So, well, of course, next council meeting, we said that it was a good idea, and all the council members says, well, that's a good idea, you know. We're glad you spent the $10 because it could have been real necessary.
Oh, yeah. But the flood didn't come.
No. Well, the flood did come, but periodically it wouldn't bother the water house, see, or the water line. So I can't remember whether it was needed or not, but the fact that when we had water, everybody, you know, haul water and fill their barrels, so in case the water line did go out, we would have fresh drinking water in the houses.
Now, besides small budget, what other problems did you face just after incorporation?
Oh. Well, I don't, that was our major.
that was a major problem.
And like we said, the reason was to incorporate was to give us a so-called pull down in Juneau.
Mm, yeah.
We had a territory, it was a territory of Alaska, and the governor was appointed by the President of the United States. Mm. It wasn't elected. But we did have some elected representative. And, well, it was to give us a voice in the government of Alaska to try to do our things, and then it gradually came revenue sharing and whatever, and it went on and on. But it was hectic, if I remember right.
Yeah.
When they talk about money now, they got what, $500,000 budget every year, you know, I says, my God, what they doing with it? They're spending it. They must spend it because we couldn't, why heck, we had a hard time even getting stamps.
Yeah.
You know, they were all of 3 cents. You know?
Almost 100 times more than you guys.
Yeah. It was really something when I think of that back, you know, the problems we had. And of course, during the spring, we tried to get a village cleanup campaign, see? And we got most, first we started, we had to get volunteers. Just ask somebody, and we did what we could. Because, you know, they said, you want to pay? They said, we got no money. I mean, how can we pay you? So we did the best we could.
Yeah.
And I think we did a darn good job, probably mm-hmm. better than they're doing now with all the money they got. But it was rather, like I said, rather difficult.
Yeah. Things change at all with statehood?
For the worse.
Well,
for the overall worse.
Yeah, perhaps. But it's partly changed the fact that we were gradually getting, should I say, sophisticated, you know. And if our legislature wouldn't do anything, we'd say, well, hey, we'll raise up and get 400 or 500 votes against you.
Oh yeah.
And we had some clout.
Learn the ropes, I guess.
That's right. And this was one of the main reasons why we got Reverend Marson as our first president. We discussed that a long time, and, well, we were, of course, all living here and kind of out of the way, you might say, and we all of a sudden we were going to be faced with letter writing, political pull.
Oh, yeah.
And the form and how to do things. And we thought he was a reasonable fellow that came from the state someplace, that fairly educated, so he would help us sort of get the ropes going. And he did his thing, and as time went by, we learned ourselves and did it ourselves.
When we first started the village here after the 49 flood, the BLM came in and surveyed. BLM hired Johnny Melville and I to survey, and we didn't, there was no planning. All we did was just divide the lots. We didn't even allow for right of way for lights or anything, so what survey lines that we put in were exactly what they were, just lines. It wasn't, there was no streets or nothing. But the way we acquired our land was that we had a bid for it. Before we did that, most of the houses were up, so that you have a house, you're the only bidder.
Yeah.
So I don't know how they set their, they had their price set up, but some of the lots were going for $30 and others were going for $35.
It was the cost of surveying.
Yeah, right.
Oh.
Right.
And what they did is after they surveyed, for instance, before that, if you wanted to build a house, you just took a likely piece of ground, you said, hey, I'm going to build here, mm-hmm. and you build. And if you wanted a little yard, you either put a fence around it or say, hey, this is mine. And when they came in and surveyed, they surveyed all these lots as best they could. And the owner, the one that's living there, had first option to buy it, and it was just the cost of surveying. This is where people were living.
Yeah.
And then some of the vacant lots, of course, were put up for a bid, and some people acquired land that way, but they were just vacant lots. Mm-hmm. But before that, it caused a lot of dissension because, mm-hmm. in fact, here it is, I'm living here for 20 years and they want me to buy it, they're crazy. You know, but it was very minimal. If I remember right, there was $25 to $30 a lot, depending on the size. The smaller ones would, $32, $33 probably is low, which, you know, it was. But then you've got a clear title to it.
Yeah. You're making $15 a month. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, right. But of course, we have to remember that money was worth a little more.
Oh, yeah.
Because remember one time is that when they started forest fire fighting, it was very primitive.
Yeah.
And of course, we had naturally no airplanes or helicopters, so we had to go by boat or walk. And summer of 43, just before I got in the Army, we had draft boards here too, by the way, Second World War. And I went up the Porcupine with some guys. We went by boat about 90 miles up the Porcupine, and we had some case goods. And fortunately, we had a guy by the name of Joe Herbert, an old man, and he had his canoe and his shotgun. So we ate pretty well on that trip, but it was strictly feed yourself or come back.
Is that Bell Herbert's husband?
Yes.
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 Yes, that's right.
Paul Herbert.
Right. He was an old man there, but very, very active. And like I said, he was getting, we were getting 75 cents an hour, by the way. You know, I came back after a week and I had $54. Man, that is a
lot of money.
Big money. Big money. But we did the best we could as time went by. And I think some of the guys put in a lot of work for nothing.
Yeah.
Like Mardo said, the council members, of course, were never paid. I don't know if they're paid even now.
I don't know.
But still, at the moment, yeah, they don't have to work like we did. Mm-hmm. In other words, they could, there's still a lot involved, but they could tell the city manager, hey, take care of this and do that. So at that time, if we decided to whatever, we'll say, well, tomorrow morning we'll go up there and we'll do it. Or if whatever had to be done, you'd have to see that it was done. Or do it yourself, whatever. That was strictly no pay.
When did you officially start having mayors?
We started right then.
Right then.
We might have called him president.
Well, yeah, we were at that time president. I think Jonathan became a mayor, didn't he?
That's right. No. But wait.
He is mayor now.
Okay.
Right.
We were.
Yeah,
we were a fourth class city.
Mm-hmm.
This was the lowest class you could incorporate.
Oh.
And all of a sudden, the state of Alaska says, no more fourth class cities. You will be a second-class city, and I think then is when we had mayor.
I believe so.
I think he was the first mayor.
That strikes my mind, but it was just a matter. It was just a title change.
Yeah.
It made no great difference. Hmm. And the president at that time, president of the council, as we called him, and they were never elected. As such, after we had election, well, if there were seven members elected, or three or four, whatever it happened to be, we would sit down together and says, hey, he looks like a sucker, we'll make him
president. You know, exactly the way I became a president.
That's right. And what we did is we vote on it, see? We'd vote on it, you know, among the seven. Among the members only, see, the populace had no say in it.
Oh.
As such, all they did is elect X number of council members. And then we'd sit down together, and sometime we'd do a little back room politic, and says, look, hey, I don't want to be president. Let's you and I get together and talk to a couple other guys, and we'll vote this guy in, see? So, real democracy at work.
Yeah,
so we'd sit down at the first council member meeting and we'd have a little blank piece of the paper, you know, like so.
And we'd, it's like, already made out.
Already made out. Well, yeah, we knew who was going to vote for. So we'd write their names down and fold them up and hand them to the city clerk. And she'd read them and says, aha, Mardo got five votes. He's your new mayor. And no objection. We never had any anyway. But this is how we did it. And I think they still do it now as a mayor. I'm not sure how they do it. I believe they do. Or they probably get together and discuss it. Probably. Because so nowadays, I suppose if somebody didn't want to be mayor, they say, I'm not going to take it. And really, there's nothing they can do about it. I think it's more planned ahead of time. So, and going back to the 49 flood, is that I think among other reasons why we incorporated is that people were all living downtown there, way down below the, where would it be? Well, anyway, below the old AC company along there. And then when the flood came, a lot of houses were washed away and some were damaged, and they moved up here. And it's sort of, you might say, a new start. And it seemed like they were getting along pretty good as with their regular chiefs and so on. But all of a sudden, everybody was up here, and we were involved with, well, the Red Cross was here, and probably the Civil Defense, and so on. And I think this helped us realize that we're going to have to do things through the legal process,
yeah.
Writing letters and ordinance, where I'm not sure whether they had rules before, but they were never, they probably didn't have the force of law.
No, it didn't. All it was just respect.
Right, right. It didn't have the force of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just, as Mardu says, just respect, and people pretty much did those things. But like I said, all of a sudden, we decided that we're not going to have to get into it. Yes, they might have, because, they did that between the fourth and second class city. They just did it. I mean, all of a sudden we woke up in the morning and, you know, we're a fourth class city. It was no discussion or nothing. They just passed a law in Juneau, and that was it. And we acquired more powers, I guess you would say.
More paperwork.
This is where the city manager came in, because there's a terrific, well, among this, these things caused it, because it gradually became more and more paperwork, and you had to write to the Juneau and keep track of your stuff. For instance, fire protection, streets, roads, light, and telephone. You had to keep track of these things, see, because we just met once a month, and that was it. Between the time from meeting to meeting, there was very little activity as such, because, well, we always had to do our thing, whatever it was, make a living, and we had to have somebody looking into these things. In other words, get your budget in at 15th of March or whatever it happened to be, and decide what you're going to do, and things like that. And the council would just say, well, you know, this is what we're going to do, and turn it over to the city manager, and, you know, next month, you know, let us know how you're doing.
Who was the first city manager? Pickey, was it Pickey?
Probably.
It might have been Richard Carroll. We had any number of them, of course, as time went by.
But I moved away before then.
Yeah, and we didn't have a manager here at that time.
Oh, what time? When was that? Do you remember the year, by any chance? Or roundabout, I mean.
I don't know.
I think that was the land thing, isn't it?
I don't know.
I think so. I think it started around then. Because Jonathan was the first manager. The land thing, I started in 1971.
I can't remember. No, the years just flow into one another, and it, you know, time just goes by, and you. I'm sure Richard Carroll will know, because he was here most of the time, and he's been involved with the city for a long time.
He's getting out of that now.
I guess so, but remember when we started, Richard Carroll was a young boy. That's right, because right. You see, it's you know, I mean, he's a middle-aged guy now, but we're talking about something that happened, you know, 30 odd years ago.
Yeah.
See, so, you know, as time goes by, this old plug sit back and do nothing. I was working on my chainsaw, by the way.
You said he wasn't going to be up here very long.
Oh, yeah. Well, I enjoy this, and it's very necessary.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that I don't want to do anything. It's just that I got my chainsaw in about a dozen parts, you know.
Yeah.
And they get a think about cutting wood pretty soon. 90 above cut wood. Yeah, but it's going to be 60 below right soon. Let me tell you, if you don't have wood in your yard, I have oil, but...
That's so expensive. What's that go for a gallon?
If I remember right, last fall it was about 180. Jeez. Last fall.
When did that all... When did people start using more oil than wood?
Gosh.
Is that very long ago? Was that quite a while?
Oh, well, let me think now. Not really long ago. 15, 20 years, 65. Oh,
yeah.
Neighborhood of 20 years. It gradually started. When
I don't think it's that long, because we moved to Fairbanks in 1965. That was the year my old man got over there behind us, and he said, I'm not able to cut wood anymore, so let's just settle in Fairbanks. And we did. We didn't know nothing about oil either then.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of years after that, that's when they brought the oil heaters in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
67.
Right. But anyway, by the time that when Mr. Toussaint got his generator going, he had to have oil, of course. And then I believe he was agent for Standard Oil Company, so they got a little extra oil, and one or two guys would put an oil stove in. And of course, we didn't know a lot of things. You put the quarter-inch copper tubing outdoors and fill in a barrel, and naturally at 60 below, it would freeze. But we gradually learned by watching somebody had trouble. He says, I remember myself when I put in oil, I debated for a long time. And I watched these guys, and I says, now, you have any trouble? Yeah, oil tank freeze. And look, and then he's got a little cork copper tubing outdoors. So I said, when I put mine up, I'm going to put an inch and a quarter pipe inside the house from the tank. So when time come to get oil, I put in my own tank, and I put an inch and a quarter going inside. There, then I reduced it to the quarter inch copper tubing to feed the stove. But we kind of learned these things gradually, hard, like propane. About this time, people started getting propane for their cook stove. And we did the same thing. We put the propane tank outdoors, and lo and behold, at 45, your propane tank would freeze.
Yeah.
So we gradually, a lot of people sort of figured out a way to do it. And for instance, put a little insulated box around the propane tank, and maybe put a light bulb in there, and you know, then it wouldn't freeze. I got the system now. No, boy, I figured that one out. I have a nice insulated box on the side. Well, I had my problems too. That's why I learned. I have a nice insulated box on the outside, and I have a good tight-fitting door. I have my tank in there. And at one time, I had drilled a little hole through the house, about a half-inch hole into the house, so some warm air from in the house would escape out into the insulated box, because you didn't want to have it going out into the wild woods, because you're going to lose too much heat.
Yeah.
So you insulate the box as such and have a little warm air escaping in there, and this would be enough to keep the propane from freezing.
Yeah.
freeze about 45 degrees, propane will. And we have lots of days below 45. Below.
Oh, yeah.
So we kind of learn these things. It's like I said, we were pretty isolated here. And a lot of things we just learned by watching, asking questions, and seeing how other people do it. There's no such thing as calling the experts, because there was no experts. We became our own experts as time went by, and we learned these things. Slow, but we learned them.
Was there ever talk of putting a road through to Fort Buchanan?
Yes.
Is there still talk of that?
No. No. Because I know we talked about it a lot, and at one time it seemed a good idea. But then, well, I remember Minto. You remember when Minto,
oh, yeah.
Minto moved? Now, they were on the Tano River below Fairbank, and they were rather isolated. And they talked about a road, and of course it was impractical then. But then they moved to where they are now, and it was practical. But we have a tendency to forget the road has both ends, goes both ways.
You can go out, but people can also come in.
Right, right. And I'm sure if you ask those fellows, they like it. They can go in and out. But I'll bet if you ask them, they would say that's the sorriest mistake they ever made.
Because a lot of people use that road to get out to the flats.
Right, right, right. And we, for a little while, we discussed it and thought it'd be nice we'd be able to get to Circle. But then Minto was, I think, our example.
Yeah.
We said, hey, we'd better stop. Not even mention a road, because anybody from Fairbanks or whatever that had a pickup truck or whatever could come in. And you don't hear too much about it now. And I think most people would say, Bumaja.
Yeah.
I know I would.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
Minto don't like it.
Oh, it's too late, though.
Yeah, it is.
And seeing the state put it in, it's a state road. And you can't block a state road. I mean, it belongs to just as much as anybody else. So I know we were thinking about, or some people were thinking about it. Gee whiz, nice. Get my pickup truck and drive to Fairbanks, you know, what the heck, get some cheap grocery.
Yeah.
But I think, like I said, we had that Minto as an example. And we said, say, we better watch out, because everybody else can come in, too.
Yeah.
So, as isolated as we are, we'll just have to take the good with the bad. I mean, no way, no in between. Oh, I can think of.
Yeah, that pretty much covers what
I think of.
Well, if you need more, come back.
Oh, no.